Since 1776, the United States for many has been a city on the hill, a place of freedom, a place of respect for individual rights and freedoms and for democracy. And so as we approach the fall November 2024 elections, some say this is one of the most historic elections in their nation's history. So we're going to take a deep dive into the policies, the actors, and the story behind the story as we look at those elections.
A clear path forward requires looking back and learning. Good public policy requires human connection. It's a consideration of the facts, applying common sense, and innovation. It's urban, it's rural, it's real life. We all have something to contribute. We all have a responsibility to get informed, because there's a little piece of Canada in all of us, isn't there? Let's learn on this path together. This is Leaders on the Frontier.
So with me here today to talk about the 2024 elections and to go into a bit of a deep dive on this is our friend Jim Lakely. Jim is a vice president with the Heartland Institute, also director of communications. Jim has a long history as a journalist. He's certainly been on all the networks from CNN to NBC to Fox. He's also been a journalist with the Washington Examiner and has written for a host of publications. And Jim has covered the White House and, of course, the Capitol. And we're glad that, Jim, you could join us today to give us a primer in this election season. Welcome, Jim.
It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience, David. And just one quick correction. I work for the Washington Times, not the Washington Examiner, although they are similar newspapers. I just wanted to correct that. As a journalist, you know, good journalists should correct the record, right?
Okay, no offense to the Washington Times, so good catch. But welcome, Jim, and it's great to see you. And you're with the Heartland Institute. Maybe you should just clarify, the Heartland Institute is a powerhouse. What does it do?
Well, we're a think tank, and when I meet new people or even some of my longtime friends who don't know what I do for a living, I tell them I work for a think tank, and they were like, well, what's that? I don't really know what that
yes,
is.
Yes, exactly.
And it's, I guess, a way to describe it is an educational organization. We're a nonprofit, so people can donate to support our work and the research that we do on free markets, on promoting individual liberty. We focus mostly on domestic policy, but our purpose is to educate the public, to educate politicians, and to educate the world on the virtues of free market capitalism, especially in contrast to what we are seeing as a troubling rise in command and control socialism movements around the world. So unfortunately, we are quite busy trying to push back against authoritarianism and Marxism and socialism and communism, both here in the United States, especially, sorry to say, in Canada and elsewhere around the world. So we've been around since 1984. We are known globally as the world's leading think tank pushing back on climate alarmism, the idea that human activity is causing a irreversible, catastrophic climate event that will be happening in the future or that is ongoing right now. The science does not back that up, and it's a big hype machine to counter. But we do a very good job of it, even for a single organization here in the United States.
Well, it really is quite an organization. So be sure to check out the Heartland Institute's website for more information. And of course, you're nonpartisan, but you do promote those principles and that, you know, solid evidence-based analytical thinking. Is that right?
That's our aim at all times. You know, we also like to have fun, like doing shows like yours. And we have our own podcast called In the Tank that you can find on YouTube. We have a show on Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern time called the Climate Realism Show. It's newly branded as that now, where we push back on this. And it's all about, you know, I'm director of communications and the vice president of the Heartland Institute. And I have a passion, and everybody at Heartland has a passion for communicating the principles that we all stand for and to try to bring some sense to the world when especially our media, both in Canada and the United States, is corrupt, incompetent. That's why I'm out of the business now, thank goodness. And actually working against your freedom and, frankly, common sense at every turn. And they're extremely powerful. So shows like this, a podcast that a lot of your listeners also listen to, it's very important to, one, keep your sanity, and two, to learn the truth about what's going on in our countries.
Okay. Well, we certainly are kindred spirits in that regard, Jim. So bravo on your work and leadership as well as with the Institute. So we've got a lot to cover, and I'm very excited to talk with you as a as an analyst and a former journalist. You've covered a lot of things, including U.S. politics for years. So I wanted to just step back for a moment. If we talk about the United States of America, if we think of, you know, the history of that incredible country, our neighbors to the south, you're an American. What is special about the United States of America? How do you view yourselves?
Well, it's, you know, that's a great question, David. And, you know, the reason I found myself matriculating to the Heartland Institute, and this is now my job every day, is to get up and to talk about and promote freedom and liberty and free markets and against socialism and tyranny. That, to me, is a very noble calling, and I'm so proud to have it as my profession. But what makes America special is that, well, it goes back to our founding in more than 200 years ago, and that it was really the first society on earth established in which the individual's liberty is paramount. And the government is to be designed, and it is the government only exists as a necessary evil in order to make sure that your society is organized and does not fall into anarchy. And so our founding fathers in the United States developed, they wrote a constitution, and they developed a society in which your individual liberty is yours. You own it. Even if you're an atheist, the founders talked about how, you know, we have inalienable rights granted to us by our creator. You don't have to believe in a creator to actually have those rights as an individual in the United States, at least as outlined in our beautiful constitution. And so what makes America very unique is that it was the first society on earth that was organized around those very important principles, those principles of enlightenment, those principles of liberty. And other countries, of course, around the world, including our friends up there north of our border in Canada, who stuck around with the British crown a little longer than we did. But
we did.
You know, the influence of the United States and our system of government actually had a profound positive effect upon the whole entire world, at least for those societies that also embraced that kind of the liberties that the United States showed could work. You could organize an entire society and a government around the idea of individual liberty. Some countries took to it better than others. And sadly to say, the United States today and a lot of the younger generations don't seem to want to take to it at all. They take it for granted, or they think it's actually not a positive, a social good, as it really is. So that's to me, that's what America is. And that's why, you know, people that are on the right, conservatives, libertarians, are still fighting so hard today to preserve that and to kind of have a restoration of liberty in the United States.
Okay. Well, we certainly can't take these freedoms and liberties for granted. And so that's part of the context of this conversation. I think there's a long story here as we look at how those kinds of freedoms can be taken for granted, or they can be undermined actively as people seek power, money, all kinds of things. So that's a very important point. So if we look back at the election, and I'm certainly very excited to cover a lot of ground with you today, Jim, with your kind help. Because Canadians are often, we get a steady diet of information through the mainstream media, which doesn't tend to talk about, in my humble opinion, about the complexity of a lot of these issues. We often get fed very, very simplistic news stories about what's going on in the election. So we dare to dive into that. So I wanted to start off with a really basic question. Is there a brief answer as to why this election in 2024 is so important?
Well, I don't know if I can give you a short answer, and that's not always my forte, but I will try to give you an answer that is sufficient for you and your audience. As we were actually saying backstage before this this recording began, we seem to hear every election is the most important election of our lifetimes, right? And especially when it comes presidential time. Every 4 years is the most important election that we've ever seen. But I tend to agree that 2024 could really be a hinge point, frankly, in history in the United States, because actually, I'll take it back to when Barack Obama was first elected president in 2008. Talk about a corrupt media. They really showed themselves to be in the completely in the tank for leftism and liberalism. Not classical liberalism, but okay, in the tank for the Democratic Party, and especially for Barack Obama. We had children singing songs to him, or I should say public school teachers indoctrinating their children to sing songs of praise for the president of the United States in 2007 wow. Going into the 2008 election. I didn't recognize my country. I didn't realize what was going on. And he had said famously, I think 5 days before the 2008 election, that we are just 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America. And I think most people thought, well, that what he means by that is that America that had slaves is finally going to elect a black man president of the United States. I think most people thought that that's what he meant. That isn't what Barack Obama meant. He meant fundamentally transforming the United States of America into a country, both politically, economically, and socially in our social fabric, that most Americans over the age of 40 wouldn't recognize. And then he had two terms to do that.
Just hold on for a sec here, Jim. So you're saying, and I remember as well as so many people do, when Barack Obama was elected, I think a lot of people felt pretty positive about it in a way, in the sense that, well, that's great that you're in a country that anybody can get to the highest office in the land, including a half black, half white person, Barack Obama. I think that's something to celebrate. But you're saying that no, what was going on here was a different vision that wasn't really in keeping with the traditional vision of the United States. Is that what you're getting at here?
Yeah, I think that is what I'm saying. I mean, his own wife, Michelle Obama, said that only after her husband was elected president was she finally proud of her country. I think for the first time ever, we elected a president who didn't like America. He didn't like the country that he was led to lead. Thus, it needs to be fundamentally transformed. I don't know if you get the great talk show host Dennis Prager up there in Canada, but I remember a great quote from him. He says, "Try that fundamental transformation line on your wife. I love you, honey, but I think you need to be fundamentally transformed. It's not really going to go over well with the missus if you say that to her." And so if you love America, if you love what it's done, of course, every country, every human is flawed. But if you love your country and the principles upon which it stands, there should be no talk about fundamentally transforming it. But he did that
I see your point.
Yeah. So he did that over two terms. His economic vision was different than that of America. Whenever it seemed Barack Obama was representing the United States on the world stage, he would run down his own country in the presence of other world leaders. I mean, he seemed to be, again, not proud of the country upon which he was elected to represent. Frankly, I thought he thinks everything is beneath him, even the office of President of the United States. But then in 2016, Hillary Clinton was a 95% cinch, according to the New York Times, to win the election, which would have been the continuation of this fundamental transformation and going down this road. And instead, the most shocking thing in American political history happened, that a reality TV show host and New York City real estate mogul was elected president of the United States and stopped that entire agenda upon which they thought they had many years to roll out.
Okay. Wow.
Stopped it in its place.
What you're saying, Jim, is a very different point of view than a lot of people would hear, certainly in Canada, because they'd say, well, no, Donald Trump is really orange man bad. Like this is a guy who does nasty tweets. He's got a tone issue. He sounds like a criminal. And we'll talk about lawfare in a moment. But so you're saying that there was a different trajectory set all the way back when Barack Obama was elected.
100%.
So why did people vote for Donald Trump then?
I think in the 2016 election, Donald Trump was speaking to, I'll use the term, real Americans. Well, Hillary Clinton was speaking to almost nobody except for her own friends. Hillary Clinton,
her own elites.
Yeah, just the elites, you know. And it was a coronation tour for her. It wasn't a campaign. You know, she actually famously didn't even campaign in the very critical swing state of Wisconsin in the last, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months of the campaign.
Yes.
I figured she didn't need to do it. Donald Trump was out there talking to what has become really the conservative base here in the United States. And I'm sure, judging from the trucker protests that happened about a year ago in your country, that the blue collar, ordinary, quote unquote, ordinary Americans, the people who shower after work, not before work, are the real backbone of the conservative liberty movement in the United States. And Donald Trump spoke directly to them, and those people just love him. They don't care about his mean tweets. They don't care about his the tone of his skin, how orange it is. They don't care about his, you know, multiple marriages and cheating. They don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
They love Donald Trump because Donald Trump loves America. Donald Trump loves them. He thinks America is an extraordinary country, that it has a history to be proud of. And he is the only politician since Ronald Reagan to actually speak like that to the American electorate. And that's why he won in 2016.
Okay. So this is, again, a key insight, I think, that you're putting in front of us, Jim, is that there's a divide here in America between kind of the working class, working people, and I'm kind of generalizing, but the elites that don't really like the working class. And so this is something that the Canadians, we don't hear about. We think Obama was for the working people, but you're saying that's not true.
It's not true. You know, that's the thing, is that the Democratic Party used to have a stranglehold on the blue collar, so-called blue collar vote in this country. And they have they've taken them for granted, and they've basically embraced the elite. You know, a truck driver either who lives in either Missouri or in Saskatchewan is not really into what the elite institutions like Harvard are into, say, like, you know, trans rights or all of these Marxist theories that are proven failures all around the world. They don't care about that stuff. They don't think it works as much as they even know about it. But that is now the core constituency of the Democratic Party and the left in this country. The hard, radical, academic left has completely taken over the Democrat Party in this country, which is why Donald Trump, despite what anybody would think, he actually has, I would think, more than a puncher's chance to win in November. With talk about political headwinds, for crying out loud, He's under indictment in what, 6 different jurisdictions? He could be in jail by the time Election Day comes in, and he still has a great chance to win the election in November.
Yeah, no, it's really incredible. So Jim, with your help, can you help us understand who are the cast of characters in this incredible drama or play? So you mentioned the Democrats, and it's fascinating because Canadians have typically seen the Democrat Party as kind of the great party, and it has many great traditions to it, but they don't realize that the Democrat Party historically was the party of the slave owners. Ironically, it's kind of amazing, but they were historically, as you said, the party of the working class, the working people, but they flipped now to be more of a party of wokeism, if I'm using that term, like hyper-political correctness. But I would say also, are they not the party of the big state? In many ways, like they have this kind of money relationship with really big companies that feed off the largesse of the big state. Is that a fair comment, Jim, in terms of the information?
Yeah, that is a fair comment. I mean, the Democratic coalition of 30, 40 years ago, and it was solidified in the 1960s, was with the working man. Unions. Mm-hmm. Unions were a huge part of the Democrat Party's ability to win elections. Unions would rally and basically cajole their members. And they were a lot of private sector union members back then in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they would cajole them to vote Democrat. I lived a good bit of my life in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is, you know, a blue collar town with lots of union guys. Yeah. And so that was a heavily Democratic place for a very long time. But now now it's not so much. It's still Democratic, but it's not, you know, automatic anymore. But the Democratic Party has abandoned those, you know, salt of the earth, blue collar people to embrace, as you said, wokeism, to try to create a society that is frankly unreal and unrecognizable to frankly ordinary people Like they don't understand being called racist when they are clearly not and have never lived their lives as a racist person, yet they are lectured to by our society, by our corporations too, who are all in bed with the Democratic Party and the left. The whole culture, corporate culture, and our even pop culture is all swimming in that same leftist pool. You know, when you're told constantly lies about your country and also about yourself, that you're racist just because of your skin color, that you have white privilege, even if you live in a holla in Appalachia within a shack somewhere, you still have white privilege. It doesn't, those kind of things may make sense to an elite at Harvard or Yale or some elite university, but they don't make any sense to an ordinary American who gets up every day, loves his country, loves his family, and works hard every day. And what's he get for it from his own country and sometimes often his own president? That you are the problem. You are an enemy of the United States. This kind of messaging from the left is very dangerous. And I think it's lingering in the minds of a lot of voters, and it's going to really, it could lead to another Trump presidency just because of the way the left and the Democratic Party and the dominant culture, leftist culture in this country has treated ordinary Americans.
Wow. So in the political game here, by largely, it's not just the Democrats. I would also argue it's the RINOs as well. They have really left a lot of Americans behind. If you think of the working class, the blue collar ones, they've farmed out a lot of the jobs to China for, marginal profit. And of course, people like to trade, but at some point you've got to ask yourself the question, in doing this, they have really hammered the middle class in the United States. Is that how you see it?
In part, I think. I think it was Thomas Sowell who said, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs, right? And so if you do offshore most of your manufacturing to China and other places where there is either slave labor or very cheap labor, and then have those goods shipped back to you, so it's cheaper to make products 5,000 miles away, put them onto ships, bring them back to the United States, pay tariffs, then distribute them all over the United States, and you're getting a cheaper product when you buy it at Walmart or wherever you shop for things. Now, that trade-off means that my goods are cheaper now than if they were made in the United States. But then the other side of the trade-off is that they're not Americans making these products anymore like there used to be. I mean, we used to have a pretty vigorous textile industry in the South, in the United States. It's pretty much gone now. All garments are made in, overseas, mostly in China. Nike famously, they get to have a great return on their for their stocks because they make all of their materials in China. Same thing with Apple. Apple is the most wealthy corporation in the history of human civilization.
Yeah,
because all of their very expensive products are made very cheaply offshore. So, Donald Trump wants to, or at least said he did in campaigning in 2016 and when he won the election, to try to bring manufacturing back to the United States, that the trade-off has been way too far in one direction. And that is another message that I know he's out there on the stump with right now, that again is resonating with blue collar voters that used to be the bread and butter of the Democratic Party.
That makes sense. So that's a very profound shift. And that hasn't happened just recently. This has been going on for several years now. Mm-hmm. And speaking of the other party, then, we've got the grand old party, the GOP, the Republican Party. Tell us about them and what the heck is a RINO? What does that mean?
Well, RINO it stands for Republican in name only. I think it was coined maybe as long as 20 years ago. I used to hear that. And so an example of a RINO would be a Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is and it's a weird to identify him that maybe if you're not really into American politics. I mean, here's a guy who made his fortune, in finance. He saved the Salt Lake City Olympics because he was such a fantastic manager of people and complex problems. Extremely successful in business and in politics. And, he ran for president, but he was a RINO because he doesn't really believe in the conservative canon, as it were, in the United States. A conservative the Republican Party is the party for conservatives. It's the Tories of the United States. And there are many different aspects or planks in that platform that have been there for decades. And a lot of it has to do with social issues. You know, the Republican, a conservative Republican wants abortion either outlawed or at least severely restricted. And instead, we had a country in which it was abortion on demand everywhere for any reason at any time. And Mitt Romney was kind of squishy on that. You know, he was pro-life, but not really pro-life. You know, and then as a senator, you know, he's not really a strong conservative. He wasn't super supportive of necessarily, you know, conservative judges. It's the kind of, Rhino is the kind of person who likes to have the label of Republican, but doesn't quite like all that icky stuff that a conservative really believes in. Like lowering taxes, like actually reducing government, like getting the government off your back. You know, those free market principles, they mouth some platitudes toward it, but they really do prefer that elites be in charge. And that was one of the geniuses of Ronald Reagan, was that he had trust in the American people. He even said, I remember, I don't remember, I was 14, but I remember reading about how, you know, they said, well, what if you lose the election? He goes, well, that's what the American people wanted. You know, they get what they want, and I'd be fine with that. If American people want me to be president again, I'll be president again. But you can't fault the people for making their choice. We now live in a country in which even some Republicans, establishment Republicans, that seem to work against the conservative agenda every chance they get, would prefer to have us managed by elites, as long as they get to be part of that elite. They would be, and they are. But a conservative, a libertarian, believes that we are, as individuals, we have autonomy. We are not dumb. We should be able to run our lives the way we see fit. And it is an insult to the American ideal to think that we need a class of elite managers or else everything's going to fall apart. That's not how our society has ever worked. In fact, the converse is true. When you have more elites trying to manage things, that's when things go to pot.
Exactly. So is that what we mean by, in U.S. politics, the so-called uniparty, in the way that most Democrats and some Republicans, these so-called rhinos, really are basically one party where they just want the elites to run the show, big money, big companies, and squeeze out the little guy, offshore everything, go to endless wars in Iraq and God knows elsewhere. And ironically, those working people go and serve in the army and they get killed and they're paying higher taxes and they have no jobs. Am I simplifying it?
No, I don't think you're simplifying it at all. I mean, there is, I think a uniparty is the great way to put it, especially for here in the United States. I mean, the great Angelo Codevilla, who actually spoke at a Heartland Institute benefit dinner several years ago, he passed in the last couple of years. He gave his address to our organization talking about the ruling class. And it was kind of the first time I'd heard that term used, and it's since become very popular. But the uniparty is for the ruling class. And the ruling class are the kind of people who tell you that you can't have school choice because the system is the system. And parents, by the way, aren't smart enough to actually decide the best education for their children. So the ruling class will decide that. And they will also decide all of the curriculum. The ruling class are the kind of people that throw a father out of a school board meeting because he's mad that his daughter was sexually assaulted in the girls' room by a boy identifying as a female. That person gets arrested and handcuffed and lifted out of a school board meeting by the ruling class, because the ruling class does not believe that the people actually should have really any real meaningful say in the way their society is organized or even the way their own lives and communities are run. And so the uniparty is in support of that, because you will find very few rhinos who are standing up for the people who are trying to claim back their right of self-government and self-rule. Rhinos are not exactly standing on the front lines for you on that.
But for Canadians, I think a lot of us would be just shocked to hear that kind of reflection, Jim. Like, isn't that the American way? It's also the Canadian way, I think, is that it's the people's voice. It's the democratic process, a healthy debate, a respectful disagreement that we get along as citizens and we together make the decisions. It's not just like some elite browbeats us and says, oh, you can't talk about this or that. Like, I mean, this is crazy.
I'm with you, David. I mean, I'm kind of the house pessimist everywhere I go. So this is this is kind of the way it goes with me sometimes. But, you know, that is the ideal and that's the way it is supposed to work. I think we're seeing more and more that the ruling class is clutching and grabbing and actually collecting much more and more power over our lives. And we're noticing it now. And this gets back to me when I was mentioning Obama, and then there was this Trump interregnum, right? And so they had all of these ideas they were going to implement through two terms of Obama, and then there was going to be two terms of Hillary. And then who cares after that? By then, we will have genuinely fundamentally transformed the United States of America. But Trump's election, right, the people selected Trump, completely shocked the entire world, even including the ruling elites. So what did they do? They actually started spying on him before he was even president. They cooked up a Russian collusion hoax to put his entire presidency under a cloud. They harassed all of his, you know, all of his top staff. I mean, it was a nonstop ideological war by the ruling class against Donald Trump. And then as soon as Biden was elected, everything you've seen now, the reason the United States can seem a little chaotic, maybe from up there, up north, is that everything is now on fast forward. Because they missed out on those 4 years. They thought they were going to be able to implement all of this stuff. So now, boom, they took off with Joe Biden. And so now you see completely open borders. You see, you know, the idea that, you know, just every there's everything just seems out of control and everything's happening all at once, because that is the intent. It's to kind of cause chaos. And so the ideal is that the people are, you know, we're supposed to be a people with a government, you know, not the other way around. And we seem increasingly to be a government with a people.
Just hold on for a sec here, Jim.
Yeah.
You got to help me here. So you're saying something that Canadians would almost never hear. And that is that the people in charge between the elites running the show, the big administrative state there is pushing, in many respects, chaos. Like, why would any rational country have an open border is totally crazy unless you wanted to achieve some bigger purpose. So why are they creating this chaos? Is it so that people somehow give up on democracy or the American way? And in some measure, why are they doing this in your opinion?
You know, David, I ask myself that a lot, and I try not to be too pessimistic or too conspiratorial but I try to take the world as it's presented to me plainly. And when the ruling class is doing everything they can to foment chaos in your country, then you have to take them at their word. You have to take that at face value and say that's what they mean to do. And sometimes I think, again, back to that fundamental transformation line from Barack Obama. If you have a piece of property, I'm sitting here in my home right now, and I wanted to fundamentally transform my house, I would have to tear it up pretty good, if not just tear it all the way to the ground. And so, and start over again. So if your ideological goal is to fundamentally transform the United States of America into a completely different kind of country, you have to break it down first. You have to break it. And you can't fundamentally transform a happy, content, prosperous United States. Happy, content, prosperous people are not in the mood to be fundamentally transformed. They're quite happy where they are. That's what I think.
Well, it's pretty mind blowing. So we're going to keep going through this, peeling the perennial onion, as we say, because I tell you, it's not all black and white here. There's a level of complexity that we probably haven't heard before. So one key message I've heard here from you, Jim, is that there's a kind of a divide, if you will, between those people who want to kind of build the homeland, build the United States in that great tradition of liberty and respect for individual rights and freedoms, and others who kind of want to run another show that is more globalist oriented, that is really kind of doing the workaround when it comes to democracy. Is that another way to characterize this big divide?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I imagine your listeners and viewers and supporters are familiar with the World Economic Forum, the WEF. There are quite a few WEF acolytes there in the Great White North in your government. I believe Trudeau himself is a graduate of their programs for bettering the world.
The Young Leaders, I believe it's called.
Yeah, the Young Leaders group or whatever they call it. Yeah, I'll have to look that up again. I was just looking at it the other day. And so, you know, look, I'm not saying that there's some vast global conspiracy and that we're at stage 6 of 20. And, you know, I know precisely where we are in this grand scheme to remake the world in the image of the elites. But it's hard to look around and see what is happening around the world, especially in the so-called classic Western democracies like Canada and the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia and New Zealand. Basically the Anglosphere, and you have to look at that and going, what's going on around here? And then when you watch the WEF forums and Klaus Schwab with people clapping in affirmation says that COVID gave us the great opportunity to do what we've been planning to do for decades. And so when you watch all of this as an individual, you have to think there is a global ruling elite. They have plans. And you don't get to vote on them. In fact, you barely even know what they are until it's too late. And so, you know, the United States has now joined under Obama for sure, and under Biden right now. Biden's not really, he's not really president. He's not really setting the agenda. There's, in fact, you know, this is a shadow Obama administration, and everybody knows it, but our corrupt media will not report on it. He's the only president not to move out of Washington, D.C. after leaving office. He's right down the street from the White House, and the entire staff, pretty much the entire staff of the White House are his former people that are over there talking with him all the time. So,
you've been around the U.S. a long time, including Washington. So you're saying that this is kind of Obama administration number 3. Is that what you're saying?
100%.
Wow. Okay, so let's go forward to today, and we've got polls. I watch the U.S. polls carefully, too. There's a lot of pollsters that are really not pollsters, but you have Rasmussen. I think that's one of the gold standards, as you know. But if an election was held today, you're saying earlier that the GOP with Donald Trump is really high up in the polls. We don't hear about this very much in Canada. So what are the polls, Jim?
Well, I haven't checked them today for you, but I do peek at them from time to time. And as some of your listeners and followers may not know, we don't really have a national election for president of the United States. There is everybody's vote is tallied, and then one for one candidate, one for the other, and then the other minor candidates. And we count all those up and we tell everybody what they are, the popular vote. But what the United States presidential election really is are 50 individual elections for president in each of our states. As it's turned out over the last several presidential cycles, there tend to be about 4, 5, 6, maybe on the outside, 7 so-called swing states that are not red or not blue, but kind of purple. And so it's those states that the presidency will hinge. It's upon those states. And, you know, ironically, Florida used to be one of the quintessential swing states in the United States. It went so far red for Trump in 2020, it wasn't funny. And of course, Ron DeSantis, you know, swept to a huge victory over there. So that's now a deep red state is Florida. But the last polls I've checked, Donald Trump is ahead in the swing state of Arizona, which he lost last time. He's ahead in the swing state of Wisconsin in some polls. He lost that last time. He's very close in Michigan. He lost that last time, and it's looking a lot more open this time. And the same thing for Pennsylvania and Nevada for all these swing states. So it could be that Donald Trump, these things could change. If the 2016 election in which Hillary got beaten by Donald Trump teaches us anything, is to not put a whole lot of stock into polls. We have to see how people will choose. There's many reasons why polls can be inaccurate. But as you mentioned, Rasmussen is one of the more reputable and accurate polling companies in the United States. And so if they say that Michigan is in play and Wisconsin is in play, I would tend to believe them.
You bet. So what I want to do now is talk about more of these policy issues and go a little bit deeper, and then we'll talk about the 2020 election as well. But if I had to just highlight the issues as I've heard you talk about, and we've got obvious ones like the economy and wokeism or political correctness. We've got things like the open border, energy independence, or the whole climate agenda. We've got issues around censorship. We've got a lot of spending, serious deficits, and accumulated debts. I think the last time I checked, the U.S. has got at least a $10 trillion debt. It's just mind-boggling. And we've got also issues related to, the deep state and the weaponization of alphabet agencies like the FBI and CIA. And mm-hmm. then on the international front, we've got the Communist Party of China, Iran, Israel, among others to boot. So are there other issues that I may have missed here, Jim? I know I've given the quick list off, but are there other ones that are key issues in your mind?
No, those that's pretty exhaustive. And I think actually a lot of those issues are important to different aspects of the electorate. For instance, like the climate, if you ask voters to rank issues and fighting climate change, where do they put that? Overall, the electorate puts it at like number 17 of 24. It's not important to them.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize it was that low.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty low. You could look it up. It's not going to be in the top five. I could tell you that, unless you self-identify as a leftist or a Democrat, then it goes a lot higher, but not all the way to the top. What we're finding is in the polling that I've seen, that's where I think actually polling results do make a lot more sense aside from the horse race, is asking voters what they think about issues and what issues are most important to them in the election. Those, I think, are pretty accurate. So the number one issue right now is immigration on both the right and the left. Democrats, I think I saw this poll the other day, for the first time ever, Democrats said that they are in support. It's a slight majority, but they said they're in support of building a wall on the southern border. Even for Democrats, the immigration crisis is getting too much. And I think something like 88% of Republicans ranked immigration, the fact that we have open borders and it's complete chaos on the southern border. That's the number one issue for Republicans. And that happens to be Donald Trump's best issue. So just if you were to, you know, score this like a baseball game, Donald Trump is looking really good right now in about the fifth inning, because everything's breaking his way as far as issues are concerned. The economy is issue number two, and the economy was a lot better under Donald Trump than it has been under Joe Biden. Indeed. Those issues, the immigration thing is going to be a real problem. And frankly, Joe Biden is not physically or mentally equipped to even debate this issue with Donald Trump. They're not going to be able to limit the damage on this through his own personality, that being Biden's.
Okay. So, Jim, let's just pause for a sec here and give us some, I call, reality therapy about this whole immigration issue, because I think this is, again, a revelation for Canadians. If you look at the issue, there's an open border now. And before, under the Trump administration, it was highly managed. They brought it to a close. They're all in favor, of course, legal immigration. But the numbers are truly stunning. The number of people coming in, flowing into your country. What the heck is going on here? Help us understand why the United States now, under the Biden administration, would have an open border.
I try not to be too cynical about it, David, but the most cynical and straightforward explanation is that the Democrat Party is part of the we need to break the country strategy, for one. And two, they expect all of these new immigrants to be instant Democrat voters so that they never lose elections again. I don't think this is going to work. I think I have to think, if I have hope in America, I would have to think that this is the Waterloo moment for the ruling elite in the United States. That you cannot
the Waterloo moment.
Yeah, this could be the moment that just ends it all for the ruling class, or at least puts them so far back on their heels that we don't feel bothered or ruled by them anymore. Because ordinary people can understand that this is insanity. You can't let literally tens of millions of people come into the United States when you don't vet them. You have no idea where they're from, who they are, why they're here, and just let them come waltzing right into your country. There is no other country on earth that does this. You know,
Jeff, just to be clear, so the people are coming in, they're not even vetting them. They're flying them to all kinds of cities under the darkness, like they and then they give them significant cash payments, right?
Yeah.
And put them up in hotels.
Yep.
And get them on all kinds of benefits.
Yep.
And they don't even know who they are. So that's why you have a lot of gang violence happening. MS-13, you've got a importation of, you know, people that are looking for obviously a better life. But these are also people that are being exploited.
Yes.
Into all kinds of human trafficking. It's almost like who, from a compassionate point of view, would enable human trafficking?
I can't argue with you, David. I don't know how anybody could do something like that. You should want to take control of the border and discourage masses of humanity pressing toward your southern border. You should be trying to suppress that in everything you say and do as a president and as a country, just for the sake of humans, of the humanity, to prevent or to reduce human trafficking, to reduce the suffering.
Yes, indeed. And isn't this your constitutional duty to protect the integrity of your borders and security of your people?
If you don't have borders, you're not a country. You know, my wife was born in the United Kingdom. She's an American, but she was born in London, and her mother is from the United Kingdom. And she only recently became a United States citizen, and she's in her 80s. My wife and I would have no right to just move to the United Kingdom and set up shop and say, I just feel like living here. And I don't care. Exactly. I don't need a green card. I don't want you to make it. Maybe I'll be a citizen. Maybe I won't. I don't care. I just get to stay here. Great Britain would never let me do that, even though I have family ties there. And the United States, unique in the world, just allows everybody to come up. No true-blooded American who's a patriot is opposed to immigration. What they are seeing and are panicked by and really disturbed by is this complete mass of humanity that is coming up. And we see the crimes: an illegal immigrant assaulted and killed a jogger at the University of Georgia campus. I just read this morning a child was killed in Virginia. There was another illegal immigrant just recently allowed in the country and then just released. Committed sexual assault upon a child. And, you know, this is why you can't do this. We don't know who these people are. And you know, the idea that everybody that comes to the border is some kind of asylum seeker. This what drives me crazy about our elite media and our corrupt media in this country is that they call them just migrants. They're not just migrants. They are illegal aliens entering the United States, and they are not asylum seekers. Just because you think life in where you live in Central America isn't as good as you want it to be, doesn't mean you just get to come in the United States and live here. At least that's not what the law says. And we're not following the law in this country when it comes to immigration. So, you know, David, if it comes to it, I may have to be a political asylum seeker going to Canada. I will let you know. I may have to start moving to your southern border and be a mass of humanity coming that way.
Well, it is truly disturbing. And I think part of this is also perhaps a different ideology that's driving this as well. And I've certainly talked with persons like this over the years where they really don't believe that borders are important. If you read, say, I think the UN declaration or agreement around the migration of people, they're suggesting that people have a right to move anywhere they want. So this is, you know, we're all one global community. And I suppose that's true from a human point of view, but we're not all the same nation. We have this gift of self-governance. We can't just simply allow anyone in. There's a process, and otherwise we don't have any definition or viable functionality around citizenship.
Exactly right. A confident nation does not allow unlimited mass immigration into its country. It sets rules. In fact, the United States, by the way our immigration laws now, you would think, if you just read them, you would think that we are a confident first world nation, because we do have procedures in place to become a United States citizen, or even to be a guest worker for decades. You can be a guest worker for decades in the United States. We have a lot of Canadians who come down here in our entertainment news business, as a matter of fact, who have been here for a long, long time. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But there are rules and procedures in place. And you know, a confident nation is not shy to say that. That, like, no, you don't get to just come into the United States because you say that you're fleeing, you know, political oppression. You have to prove it. You have to prove your case. And instead, the messaging from the Biden administration was basically, come on, guys, come on, everybody. So they created, by their own actions, the climate crisis that's happening on the border. And they don't really care, it seems, David, about the children that are being trafficked for very evil purposes into the United States and through other countries. They don't care about any of that because they see the benefits politically and socially that enable more control with the ruling class.
Thank you for watching Leaders on the Frontier. We're a nonpartisan think tank. We explore ideas, policy, and practical solutions that can make a difference in the lives of Canadians. We do not accept any government funding. We work for you. Thank you for supporting Frontier. Visit fcpp.org to give. While you're there, be sure to check out our latest articles and research. Without open discussion and debate, you're not thinking, nor are you free. Comment below. We'd love for you to join the conversation.